Hello, welcome to the EI Podcast. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and my guest today is Dan Wong, Research Fellow at the Hoover History Lab at Stanford University. And he's the author of the highly acclaimed book, Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Paul.
Now, the word engineer is crucial, absolutely central to the thesis that you advance in this remarkable book. China, you argue, operates as an engineering state, as opposed to the US, which you describe as a lawyerly society. So we have engineers versus lawyers. What is it that you mean by those terms, and what do they tell us about those two societies?
By engineer, I want to move beyond these 19th century political science terms like socialist, capitalist, autocratic, and a slightly more contemporary form of term, neoliberal, to try to understand this 21st century competition between the US and China. And I think that China could certainly and must be understood as autocratic, certainly. But I want to advance our sense of what is going on in that big country a little bit beyond these textbook terms. And so, having lived in China from 2017 to 2023, experiencing Donald Trump's first trade war, China's surging technological capabilities, new forms of repression, and especially living through all 3 years of zero COVID, made me wonder if engineering isn't a better term for what Xi Jinping and the rest of the Communist Party is attempting to do in China. So I think a lot about how in the year 2002, all nine members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo had degrees in engineering. The top guy then, Hu Jintao, had a degree in hydraulic engineering. And that is kind of my animating metaphor for this idea that the Communist Party treats the economy, society, the physical environment as yet another hydraulic system, as if people will go where they need to go through a series of valves. And I think about engineering in terms of China's major construction boom of the last four decades, which built so many new highways, bridges, solar, wind, coal, nuclear power plants, homes, etc. throughout the country. How Xi is also attempting to engineer the economy by pushing away smart people from working in consumer internet or financial sector to work instead in semiconductors or aviation or more strategic technologies. And how the Communist Party is also fundamentally an engineer of the soul, which is a term from Joseph Stalin that Xi Jinping repeated about 6 years ago. And how they view society as yet another building material to be torn down and remolded as they wish.
And that's very much like the idea of the engineer of human souls.
That's right. So when Stalin first used this term, engineers of the soul, I think he said something like, you know, to the artists and writers among us, you are engineers of the human soul. And Xi Jinping said something quite similar in 2019 when he celebrated teachers on World Teachers Day, that teachers are engineers of the soul. And I write extensively about the one-child policy as well as zero COVID, which I identify as major social engineering projects in China, in which the Communist Party isn't only made up of economic engineers or physical engineers. They are also fundamentally social engineers, population engineers, engineers of the soul. And so they are very, very intent on controlling society as if it were a series of pieces on a chessboard, as Adam Smith once wrote about, to move people around where the party wants them to go.
Mm. Now, technology and innovation are absolutely central to this book. There are many, many examples from factories, semiconductors, high-speed rail, as you mentioned. And there's also, I think, a sense that, for example, the automotive industry has been very successful with EV, is the marker of an advanced society, perhaps, when they compare themselves to Germany or the US or Japan, whatever. But I wonder how this scale, this emphasis on scale and speed, affects creativity, experimentation, compared to the American model. So, for example, I was thinking recently of the Nobel Prize winning laureate, Joel Mokyr, economic historian, who puts an emphasis, this has been very crude inevitably, but an emphasis on the individual, on fierce debate, particularly when he talks about the origins of the Industrial Revolution. And so I suppose I want to get back to this idea of what America does different, and which raises the question of how innovative technologically China actually is in comparison with the United States, or is it just very good at adopting different business models?
Yeah, well, I think that it is, one cannot be but crude to talk about innovation because this concept is a very fuzzy one. What I will say is that I agree that there is a distinctive way of a mode of Chinese innovation, and it is quite different from the California mode. Now, I'm a fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. I spent quite a bit of my time in Silicon Valley. And I think the Silicon Valley model of innovation is that we take Steve Jobs, send him into a garage, and then send some LSD after him, or some magic mushrooms, and then out comes an Apple computer at some point, or an iPhone a little bit later. And my view is that that is not the only model of innovation, that Silicon Valley does not have a monopoly on the definition of innovation, because someone had to actually construct the iPhone. And that someone is usually a worker sitting in Shenzhen or in the Southeast or someone in the province of Henan, which is further in the north, actually assembling a lot of these very sophisticated electronics, which Apple can depend on only China to do, for the most part, to assemble most of their sophisticated components. And I think the Chinese model of innovation is that it will wait for the Americans to do some of the more sophisticated science, some of the more groundbreaking stuff, wait for the Americans to de-risk and figure out most of the established science. But once the science is figured out, what the Chinese firms will do is to actually manufacture the damn products and actually own the industries. So I think a lot about this example of, you know, who was it who invented the first solar photovoltaic cell? It was Bell Labs in the year 1954 out of New Jersey. And what has happened to the solar industry now? Well, it is almost entirely a Chinese affair. The Chinese own something like 90% of the solar industry, everything from the upstream polysilicon processing to the downstream solar module assembly. And so when you have an example of solar, I wonder which is the greater glory. Is it to claim in the history books that Bell Labs invented solar in 1954, or is it to actually own the entire industry? And I submit that, you know, right now I would say that there's greater economic value, there is greater geopolitical benefit, there is greater glory in actually owning the industry. Because what China has is this large, very robust workforce, remarkably competitive, aided by a state that sometimes gets in the way and sometimes lends a helping hand in order to own all of these industries. And what the Chinese can't afford to do is to let the Americans figure out innovation, whatever that means, create a lot of ladders, and then expect that American firms cannot actually climb the ladders that they themselves lay down and wait for the Chinese firms to actually climb these ladders. And that is something that we see happening again and again, in which the Americans or the Europeans or the Japanese do some fundamental scientific research, but then their own firms do not properly take advantage. Then the Chinese are simply scanning the horizon for what is going on in the world and then actually owning these industries because the Americans can't do the job.
And in the section, I think it's the chapter called Process Knowledge, you argue that this manufacturing advantage that China has isn't just about raw scale anymore, if indeed it ever was, but a kind of practical expertise. And how do you see that evolving over the next decade? For example, we've had the China 2025 plan that was inaugurated in 2015, actually.
Yes.
And do tell us something about that and what were the ambitions and whether they've been fulfilled or not. But can China sustain, or can it gain this manufacturing advantage, but also can it sustain it? And I suppose most importantly of all, what might derail that?
Well, first thing to say is that scale is indeed important. Now, I hesitate to quote Joseph Stalin too much, but I will indulge in just one more Stalin quote, which is that quantity is a quality all its own. And I think that there is something actually quite profound here, in which the Chinese have started with scale, namely cheap labor, and have actually turned that into a durable source of technological advantage. Now, I understand technology to represent three distinct things. I think we are often very fuzzy when we talk about innovation. I think we're also very fuzzy when we talk about technology. But let me try to be a little bit concrete about what I understand technology to be. So I believe that technology is, first and foremost, a set of tooling and equipment in a kitchen analogy that is something like pots, pans, and the stove that we use to cook something. Next, technology is written instruction. So this is everything that includes patents, blueprints, as well as direct recipes that we use to cook a dish. Third and most important, I believe technology is process knowledge. And process knowledge is essentially everything that cannot be codified into tooling and cannot be directly written down. It is all of this knowledge that exists between people's heads and within people's heads that is actually represented by a practical experience of how to do things. You can also refer to this as industrial expertise, as tacit knowledge, but it is all of these things that are impossible to write down. And so imagine if we give someone who has never cooked a day in his life the most exquisitely equipped kitchen, as well as a super detailed recipe. I'm not sure that we can count on him to do something as simple as fry and cook scrambled eggs, because even that requires a little bit of a challenge. And so it is all of this process knowledge that is represented by a skilled workforce that has substantially dissipated in the United States, dissipated even further in the United Kingdom, in which the about 11% of American GDP is made up of manufacturing, quite a lot below China's 25% roughly, quite a lot below Germany's 20%, but still a few hairs higher than the UK's 9%. And so when you have a lot of the manufacturing workforce dissipate, move substantially around various regions within Europe or the United States, but also towards China, what China has is a very robust workforce of about 70 million manufacturing workers that are solving three new problems a day before breakfast: to assemble new phones, assemble new electric vehicle batteries. They're constantly confronting new problems that they have to solve that don't have to depend on what is going on in Washington, D.C., or indeed Beijing, to figure out their new technological challenges. And when you have this learning that is going on in this very deep and robust labor force of, again, about 70 million people, that is what I see to be the crucial Chinese advantage in building out new products. They are learning new things, and they are on the forefront of inventing new products, because so much of this experience, so much of the, you know, what is actually happening on the ground with innovation cannot be captured in either Cupertino or some part of the British research universities. And they are very intent on figuring out the next new and great products. And I think that this is the sort of thing that isn't very easy to derail. I think that China is very focused on maintaining process knowledge within its borders. They are hesitant to let too many Chinese engineers go over to, let's say, India to teach Indian workers how to produce better phones. They are very intent on automating a lot of their own workforce to codify more of this knowledge into machine tools or blueprints or recipes. And so long as this workforce is in China, I think that guarantees that China will be at the forefront of all sorts of new products going forward.
I want to have a look at two demographic factors here. One is that it's no surprise to anyone to say that China is a very large country. And I just want to get some sense of the distribution of the manufacturing industry, the infrastructure. Where are the powerhouses there? And then I want to look at the demography and the split in society between those who work for the state and those who are entrepreneurs. This concept that of 996, for example, working 9 till 9, and whether this hard work is rewarded. There's a lot of demographic factors here. You've already mentioned the one-child policy and the problems that have arisen from that. But I just wanted, if you could paint a kind of demographic picture of the geography, of the generational differences and the challenges that young Chinese people in particular face.
First, on geography, it used to be the case that Chinese manufacturing was heavily concentrated in a few corners of the country, namely the southeast with Guangdong province, which borders Hong Kong, which had received earlier investment. There's also the region around Shanghai, namely Zhejiang province, as well as Jiangsu, which has been a historic center of manufacturing. And then there's parts of the north and around Beijing and Tianjin, which led a lot in manufacturing. And these are all relatively coastal parts of China that were better integrated into the global economy. And the vast countryside further out in the west, in the southwest, northwest, as well as the central part of the country, did not enjoy too much by way of manufacturing. But I think at this point, we can say that the coastal-driven manufacturing story, though it is still pretty dominant, is a thing of the past because there are now many inland parts of China that are leading in various industries. So there are the leaders in automotives are no longer necessarily clustered around the coasts. I cycled through China's fourth poorest province, Guizhou, which makes about, I think, something like a third of all the guitars in the world. And so, you know, just you take a look at almost any corner of the country. There's still a lot of agriculture there, but there is now increasingly sophisticated and advanced manufacturing that is not just simply a coastal affair. And if we take a look at some of the work culture in China, I think part of the reason that the geography has dispersed is that the educational levels and the nutritional levels and the health levels around the country has improved across the board, such that, you know, human talent isn't relatively concentrated in richer parts of China. There is a lot of opportunity for people to move around, study what they perceive to be economically valuable, and for China to have a relatively high human capital pool to draw on to do a lot of advanced manufacturing. And if you are really elite, you are probably not going to be working in the manufacturing industry. You're going to be just like your American peers or British peers to say, I would rather work in a consumer internet company or in the financial industry instead, because the salaries in these industries are so much higher than in manufacturing. Now, 996 has been a phenomenon for a while, sometimes jokingly superseded by 007, in which you're working from midnight to midnight, 7 days a week. That is, of course, an exaggeration. No one can possibly work that level. But I think the work culture in China is very, very fierce, much as it is in nearby South Korea or Japan, where people really spend a lot of time in the office. And I sometimes admire the British bravura of working quite hard, but pretending that one does not have too much work going on, that one is never really supposed to have this affect, that one is working too hard. It is much more about a state of relaxation. And in East Asian cultures, that looks rather more difficult. I think one of the challenges demographically among youths these days in China is that it is not too much fun to be working in 996. It is more challenging to be working in tech companies or finance companies, which have drawn a lot of the ire of Xi Jinping. Xi has famously smacked a lot of tech founders around, whether that is Jack Ma of Alibaba or Zhang Yiming of ByteDance. And a lot of these companies have felt some degree of precarity because they don't know if the censors will ever come after their business. Xi has also crushed a lot of parts of the financial sector after instituting a pay ceiling of about $300,000 for a lot of folks who work in finance in China. And some folks who make over $300,000 may have to give back some of their income to the state if they're working for state-owned enterprises in banking. And so I think young people are feeling a little bit adrift. Many of them are unable to find jobs. Youth unemployment in China is really, really high. And the sort of jobs that they could get that are especially well-paying in the financial and consumer internet industry feel like they could be a little bit dangerous because you never really know when Xi might come over and completely smash an industry like he did with online tutoring several years ago. And so I think that speaks a little bit to how the engineers are really grab and smash in all sorts of ways, and people don't feel very secure living in that environment.
And does the party realize that?
I think the party cannot help but realize that. And I think that the party has no creative solutions for really managing that. Now, it is obviously the case that a lot of rich people over the last 5 years have decided to move their money and themselves away from China because they are hesitant to keep building wealth in China. There's a survey out from a UK-based consultancy a year ago that something like 14,000 millionaires left China in 2024. They moved to Singapore, they moved to Tokyo, they moved to the United States, they moved to London because they feel insecure. A lot of creative types, journalists, folks working in state media, folks working in movies and the arts have decided to leave China. They go to New York or Amsterdam or Chiang Mai, where they are able to play with cryptocurrencies, indulge their creative pursuits, smoke drugs that may be legal in the state of California because China is pretty repressive for a lot of creative folks. And most astonishingly, in 2023 and 2024, the United States was picking up something like 30 to 40,000 Chinese nationals at the peak from the US-Mexican border, in which Chinese were fleeing to Ecuador, where they don't need visa access, and then walking across, making a very dangerous trek to walk across the United States border. These are people who are not necessarily creatives. These people are not necessarily rich, that they want to do this dangerous trek of to take leave of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation that's being undertaken in their name. Now, I think that if you're a member of the elite in Beijing, you're not very comfortable with what's going on. A lot of folks, as I mentioned, working in tech and finance are not sure whether their companies might be smacked around. And if you are within the party elite or the military elite, you also feel uncertain about your own position. Last month, Xi announced that Beijing had detained about 20 generals, flag officers of the People's Liberation Army, for various transgressions involving either corruption or political disloyalty. And imagine if you are in this party elite, if your patron goes down, the entire network falls. And so you're never very sure if you will be able to stay on top in Beijing for a very long time. And it is highly unusual for Xi to purge a sitting member of the Politburo, who is one of the 20 or so generals who are being purged. And I wonder how many folks inside the Politburo actually feel like they have a pretty confident grasp of what Xi Jinping thinks about and wants on a day-to-day level. I do more than a handful of Xi Jinping's close associates really feel like they are in a secure position. I'm not very sure.
And what for those young Chinese who have ambitions that are stifled in the homeland? Is there relative freedom of movement? You mentioned about people going to Thailand, going to Tokyo. I mean, what are the provisions there?
I think if you are a young person, you will do what you can to be able to leave if you find that valuable. Now, the first thing I'll acknowledge is that emigration is a totally minority pursuit. Less than 1% of the population would even properly contemplate it, I think. It is an option available to very few people. If you are established in Beijing with a family in your 40s or 50s, even if you're working at a relatively elite firm or for the government, those people do not really consider emigration. Few of them consider emigration because they have elderly parents to support, or they have a kid in school, which it is pretty disruptive to remove them. And so I think that emigration is an option considered by the desperate or by the young. And the desperate may be fleeing because they have suffered some sort of a political issue at home. Maybe they have been nabbed by the police for saying the wrong thing on the internet. Maybe they're just seeking economic opportunity, which is probably better for them, they perceive, in Texas or California or New York than it is in China. Or they are the perpetrator of some sort of fraud that the police are seeking them for, whatever the case is. And if you are part of the young, you feel like your life is still ahead of you. You are interested in your creative pursuits. Maybe you're interested in broader liberal values. Maybe you're just interested in working in cryptocurrencies, which is a much more difficult industry to pursue in China, and they make preparations to depart. And once they've made that determination, it is still a relatively challenging program to attempt to go to, let's say, Tokyo, which is not necessarily offering a lot of visas. Maybe they move to continental Europe, but they have to do so by applying for a master's program at, let's say, a Dutch university or a British university, which could still be pretty pricey. Moving to the United States is not necessarily very straightforward, especially in Donald Trump's America. And even going to a place like Chiang Mai, that is doable, but it is doable more in short spurts. It is you can have visa-free travel to go to Thailand, but in order to stay longer term, you have to declare yourself to be a student. It could be easy to finesse that because you could be taking lessons in Thai, in the Thai language, or doing martial arts, Thai Muay, boxing might enable you to become a student. But there's plenty of people who are wondering what their long-term future is in Thailand because they may not necessarily find a job very easily. They don't necessarily want to attend Thai language lessons many times a week. And so it is an activity available only to a few. And even then, it is not always very clear that these people have been able to make the right choice in order to attain better economic or political outcomes once they depart.
Now, your book is predicated, Dan, on this opposition of engineers and lawyers. And to move the perspective somewhat to the United States, just give us a brief outline of what you mean by a lawyerless society, both the benefits and the drawbacks.
The United States has been governed by lawyers for a very long time.
Since the beginning, one might say.
Let's say it's exactly since the beginning. If we read the Declaration of Independence, it really feels like the start of a legal brief on filing for some sort of a divorce from the crown. Among the first 16 U.S. presidents, from George Washington to Abraham Lincoln, 13 of them were lawyers. And in the modern day, five of the last 10 U.S. presidents had attended law school. The Democratic Party is especially lawyerly. If we take a look at presidential nominees from the Democrats between 1980 to 2024, all of them had attended law school. And I would say that there is something about the lawyerly style in Trump, Donald Trump as well. So Donald Trump did not go to a law school, but we cannot understand Donald Trump's business career without seeing that lawsuits have been absolutely central to his entire life. This man has sued everyone. He has sued his former business partners. He has sued his political opponents. He has sued his former lawyers.
He's even sued the BBC.
He has even sued the BBC for something like $1 billion. Isn't that right?
Or threatened
to. So he loves to sue. And I think there is something with his style of governing, which is about flinging accusations left and right, which is trying to intimidate. The BBC director has recently resigned, and he is trying to establish guilt in the court of public opinion. And I think what is good and bad about the lawyerly society, at least with respect to America, is that lawyers are much better at obstruction than construction. And so you don't have stupid ideas like the Why Child policy. You also don't have functional infrastructure almost anywhere in the United States. Now, I want to further praise and also damn the lawyerly society a little bit further, which is that I believe that America is the best country in the world to be a member of the rich. If you are, first of all, it is possible to get rich in the United States. If you're a member of the rich in China, you're probably going to be subject to some degree of political bullying from the Marxists, Leninists who run the Communist Party. And in Europe, it's not even possible to get rich anymore. Taxes are so high, and it seems like every rich person is rich from the result of some form of inheritance. In the United States, it's still possible to be rich. You feel politically secure to be a member of the rich. The rich feel comfortable to create big companies in America. And I think it is pretty remarkable that the West Coast of the United States is the only region in the world that has created not just one company over $1 trillion, but several companies over trillions of dollars. Meta is now worth over $3 trillion. Apple is now worth over $4 trillion. NVIDIA is now worth over $5 trillion. Completely remarkable. But I think that the United States cannot stay a great power for long if it works exclusively for the benefit of the rich. The rich don't have to worry about high housing costs. They don't have to worry about getting to around in New York City through the subway, which does not work terribly well. And I want America to work better for more members of the middle class, the working class, who do take mass transit, who do need more affordable housing, who do need cheaper energy prices for economic security.
I was taken by one of the passages in your book when you mention the remarkable similarity between the American and Chinese people. And in fact, you write, there's a passage here, that they offer a strain of materialism, often crass, runs through both countries, sometimes producing veneration of successful entrepreneurs, sometimes creating displays of extraordinary tastelessness, and overall contributing to a spirit of vigorous competition. And that raises the question that we often see competition between the United States and China as a zero-sum game. But I wonder if, and our friend Stephen Kotkin has mentioned this, that ultimately, if they are to avoid destruction, US and China have to share this earth together and prosper, whatever their differences. And I wonder if there's a sense that rather ultimately than a zero-sum game, there might be some sort of hybrid model emerge that suits both parties?
Well, I sometimes have this debate with our friend Stephen Kotkin, in which I completely agree with him that both countries are here to stay. Neither the United States nor China will simply sink into the Pacific. They are going to have to live with each other for a very long time. And Stephen's idea for how to think about this relationship, the good outcome would be something like a Cold War. And I have various objections, and we debate about this back and forth. I think the good thing about the Cold War is that it is not a hot war, but it still conjures these elements of zero-sum competition, which is fully endemic into this sort of, at least in late Cold War, according to George H.W. Bush, who said, our model of the Cold War is that we win, they lose. And so I think that it is, I'm still a little bit allergic to embracing fully this idea of the Cold War. But I, do wonder about how these two countries will be able to live with each other. And I really believe that Chinese and Americans are very similar. They believe they are great countries and other countries are small countries and they have to get in line behind them. The people are very dynamic. They are pretty crass and materialistic. And it's no accident that Shenzhen and Silicon Valley are really driving the future, as well as Wall Street and Beijing. And I think there is an element of Girardian competition here. There is an element of Schmittian, you know, friend-enemy distinction here. And this is where things can get really dangerous if, you know, we don't pay attention to what sort of Girardian competition that we are really engaged in. And I am, in fact, a little bit fearful of any sort of a hybrid model, because I think, you know, one outcome that might be good for the world is that US and China somehow forget all of their differences and manage to become friends. Well, as a Canadian citizen, as someone who comes from a small country, I wonder, you know, what is going to happen to other countries if the biggest bullies in the world decide to be best friends? And that probably is a more dangerous world for the rest of humanity.
And it's harmful for democracy as well, for liberal democracy, if that's diluted in the United States as well.
It could be, depending on, you know, which way the dilution runs. I would be more hopeful if we can actually dilute the Communist Party with a with a dose of liberal democracy, although I'm not very hopeful for that scenario. Last month, I wrote an op-ed for The Economist's By Invitation column to say that the United States is learning a lot of the worst lessons from China, that Donald Trump is visiting misfortune upon many of the least fortunate people, that he is turning Intel into a state-owned enterprise with American characteristics, that he expects adulation and praise for every major policy announcement, as well as its reversal. And unfortunately, what the United States is getting is authoritarianism without the good stuff.
And so if you were advising policymakers in the US, from your experience, when you think about the engineering state that you describe, what policy changes would you recommend based on your experience?
Rather than building gilded ballrooms or detention centers, how about building some things that broader masses of folks actually demand, like mass transit and better infrastructure throughout the country, as well as solar and wind energy to decarbonize the economy instead? And these are all things that China's building, in addition to certain numbers of coal plants, as well as nuclear power plants. But, you know, having a functioning manufacturing base, I think, is also one of the definite advantages of the engineering state. The American industrial base seems to me to have rusted from top to bottom, in which they were unable to build relatively simple goods like masks and cotton swabs in the early days of the pandemic. And they're unable to replenish their munition stockpile after shipping a lot of munitions to Ukraine. And so, you know, having a little bit more of the abundance mindset, having a greater public order in the streets, these are all things that the United States doesn't have to learn only from China. There are other exemplars of having more functional public works as well as manufacturing bases. We can look to, let's say, Spain, France, the Danes. My wife and I spent a month in Denmark over the summer. We're very impressed with a lot of things going on over there, as well as the Japanese, to have, you know, basically better ordered societies than the rest of the Anglosphere. And it is really the Anglosphere with its common law system that produces these really difficult construction costs totally everywhere. And my, as a starting point, when it comes to building housing or public works, what I suggest is that don't trust anyone who speaks English.
It strikes me, talking about someone who speaks English, that Trump has a slightly unusual, ambivalent attitude towards China, in the way that he doesn't seem to condemn China as forcefully as, say, he does Europe, for example. And his obsession with TikTok, for example, I find quite strange. He seems to be relatively ambivalent. I mean, is that a correct reading?
That is absolutely my reading. Now, first, does Donald Trump speak English? I'm not so sure. I think that Donald Trump is Chinese. He really is a recognizably Chinese character in a way that the Communist Party fully understands. I think Donald Trump respects, first of all, Xi Jinping, as he does many other autocratic strongmen. He has repeatedly praised Xi Jinping, including in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, in which he said that Xi is, I quote nearly verbatim, So smart, brilliant, everything nearly perfect. There's no one in Hollywood quite like this guy, as if Xi Jinping is Tom Cruise levels of handsome or something. I find that a very strange remark. He is often praising the Chinese people and saying that he wants more Chinese students studying in the United States. And I think he understands that the Chinese are, many Chinese business people are just as crass and materialistic as he is. And I feel like he finds more of a kindred spirit among the Chinese than he does among, let's say, I don't know, German businessmen. Yeah. And living in China throughout the first trade war, I think a lot of the sense of folks in Beijing was that Donald Trump has never spoken a bad word about the Chinese people up until zero COVID, in which he grew very nasty indeed. But he was, even throughout the trade war, he kept praising Xi Jinping, and he was heaping contempt much more often on the Japanese or the Germans instead. And with the Japanese, perhaps we can understand he grew up, you know, throughout the 80s when the Japanese were the major economic threat to the U.S.
This is Paul Kennedy's thesis, of course.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not sure what he has against the Germans. You know, his grandparents were German. Mm. Probably that's why he dislikes the Germans. But I think he has been much more friendly towards the Chinese instead.
And Dan, I know that futurology is a fool's errand. But where do you think China will be in 10 years' time? And how will its relationship with the United States develop?
I think that the relationship between the two countries is a dynamic one, and that is what makes futurology so perilous. But my view is that there is no natural winner between the US and China. We cannot understand this competition through these megastructural forces that are relatively static, like geography or demography. I think that the US and China are locked into this competition. Whichever country is ahead is going to be committing sins of hubris and mistakes of overconfidence. And whichever country is behind is going to feel the crack of the whip in order to reform and rapidly catch up. I was living in China in 2021 when Xi Jinping, I think, was hubristic. He thought that the United States looked weak after the US couldn't handle COVID very well. After January 6th, American democracy looked somewhat more broken. And what did Xi Jinping decide to do? Well, he smacked around a lot of tech companies, especially Jack Ma, and then tried to initiate this controlled demolition of the property sector. And right now, near the end of 2025, China's economy is still weak from these two policy choices that he and the rest of the Politburo made, because China's property sector is very weak and entrepreneurialism is still shaky after these big efforts. And I think the country that is behind will really try to catch up. And therefore, I don't think that, you know, the future of these two countries is going to be static. It is going to be a very dynamic process, because the competition between them is going to last years and decades.
Well, thank you, Dan, for that fascinating survey. Dan Wong's book, Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future, is published by Annan Lane, and it's highly recommended. Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much for your insights.
This was a very fun conversation. Thank you very much, Paul.